breakfast puppies?
This podcast contains adult language and content and is meant for mature audiences. Listener discretion is advised.
Hi, I'm Kevin Sambita of Palladium Books, and you're listening to The Glitter Boys.
Well, once again, Kevin, thank you for joining us now for the fourth? Is this number four?
I believe it's fourth.
Fourth of this series.
Either that or I've forgotten how to count, which is entirely possible.
Well, I'm glad to be here, guys. This has been fun.
Yeah, this has been a load of fun. We've gotten a lot of good feedback on this. So before we dive into something, I got to ask you. When we had that very first session and we were talking about the early games, I remember at one point, I'm like, man, sure would be great if Valley of the Pharaohs were to be reprinted. And you're like, sure would. And then what do you know, 2 weeks later? Oh, man, that's really cool. How much, like, I'm guessing you were aware of this was happening at that time.
Yeah, I wasn't sure when he was going to launch, so I didn't want to say anything.
Yeah, okay.
So, yeah, the current Valley of the Pharaohs Kickstarter is by Matthew Ballant, who was one of my early cohorts at Palladium and at the Detroit Gaming Center. And Matt wrote the original Valley of the Pharaohs. And it's 40th year anniversary, and Matt's doing a super expanded, because I mean, I think the original book was 48 pages or 64 pages. And he's talking like 250 pages.
Yep.
So he's got big plans for it. He's pretty excited. It was his baby to begin with. So, yeah, he reached out to me earlier this year or end of last year and asked if he could expand it, if I minded. And I said, no, go ahead. So he's totally got my blessings. Yeah. And it should be pretty epic. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, this is normally the kind of, like, you know, side discussion topic that you would expect to have at the end of an episode. But these little interviews tend to be longer, dear listener. So right now, pause this. You've got a week left. Go back this Kickstarter project. There will be a link in the show notes. We're really excited.
Join the over dozen people on our Discord who have announced that they're backing the Kickstarter.
Yeah,
cool.
The shock game was on point when that happened. Everybody's like, what? Yeah. Well, anyway, speaking of older Palladium products.
Yes.
Today's focus would be on the Ninja Turtles. Now, I think this is the third time we've had a Palladium person, a Palladium associated or adjacent person on here to talk about the Ninja Turtles. So I'm excited to know what else we can learn. Because first it was Sean, and then it was you and Sean. And yes, more Ninja Turtles is always a good thing.
Yeah, I like them.
So, yeah. Where did the idea come that there's this weird comic book, I want to do a role-playing game out of it?
Everything gives me ideas, guys. So I had heard about Ninja Turtles. We used to get a weekly sort of newspaper kind of publication called the Comics Buyer's Guide. And it offered news and insight to comic books and things. It was like a precursor to like Wizard magazine and that kind of thing. So I knew it was coming. I'd heard of it. I thought it sounded cool. Could not find a darn issue number one to save my life. Finally, I got issue number two. I read it. I thought it was really cool. I turned to my wife and I said, man, this would be a great property to license, provided they'd let us create any kind of mutant animal character. I really liked the idea of being able to create any kind of mutant animal.
It
was just fun. I mean, come on. George Lucas has gone on record saying that, you know, the Wookiee is basically a boy and his dog kind of thing. I buy that. People always loved the Wolfen in Palladium Fantasy. So I thought this would be a great idea. I'm not kidding you. Within a few minutes, I get a call out of the blue. It's some guy I've never heard of before and says, I am a big fan of Heroes Unlimited and Palladium Books in general. have you heard of the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles? And I'm like, why, yes, I have. I just finished reading issue number 2. And he's like, I think it'd make a great role-playing game or source book for Heroes Unlimited. And I'm like, me too. And we got talking, and he thought it would be this great thing. And I said, well, you know, I got to track down Eastman and Laird. And he goes, I've already done it. Here's their number. Why don't you give him a call? And I did. And, you know, the first person I talked to was Peter Laird. I don't know who was answering the phones or what back then, but, you know, I spoke to Peter and we hit it off. I don't know if it was because we were around the same age or, you know, I had a background in comics or anyways, we just hit it off. And he said, you know, obviously I got to talk to my partner, Kevin, but it sounds very interesting. And we had a couple more conversations. I met Kevin Eastman on the phone and we hit it off too. And they said, yeah, let's go for it. So, I mean, you know, I was a startup company about, 4 or 5 years old at that point. They were a brand new company, like a year and a half old. So they said, well, hey, you've got more experience. Why don't you write the contract?
And I'm like, nice.
Okay, I guess I can do that. And, you know, I wasn't out to take advantage of anybody or anything.
Yeah.
You know, I was a fan. They were cool guys. So, I threw together a contract. They said, yeah, it looks fine to us. And the rest is kind of history.
Yeah, for a moment there, I thought you were about to say, I got to talk to Eastman and Laird. And he'd be like, well, I am Eastman and Laird. I'm like, whoa, wait, what?
No, that would have been super cool.
Yeah, it would have been great. So just a moment ago, you had mentioned a magical term for me, which is a boy and his dog. Great story, great comic, and great movie, but also from a great writer named Harlan Ellison. And I've got a note here to ask Kevin about Harlan Ellison and the Ninja Turtles.
Yeah, well, that's a fun story. So apparently Harlan Ellison was a big Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle fan.
Nice.
And he also collected miniatures and had someone who painted minis. So one day at the Palladium office, we get a call, and my wife says, hey, there's a guy on the phone who says he's Harlan Ellison and he wants to talk to you. And I'm like, what?
Oh, my God.
And I, exactly. And it's already like after hours because, you know, he's California, I believe. Yeah, yeah. And so I pick up the phone. I go, hello. And he goes, hi. Is this Kevin? And I'm like, yes. He goes, the publisher of Palladium Books. I'm like, yes. He goes, I'm Harlan Ellison. And I'm like, the Harlan Ellison? And he's like, yes, I'm the himself. And he went on to explain how he had to know what the color scheme was for Doc Farrell and the various characters because he had someone who was painting up his minis and they had to be exactly right.
Oh my God.
Yeah, that's one of those things that a lot of people don't know about Harlan Ellison. I think he may have single-handedly kept a whole host of early pro miniature painters employed.
Wow, I had no idea.
Yeah, I didn't either. It was crazy. You know, I'm like, well, Harlan, you can paint them whatever you want. He goes, I know that. I want to know what the exact colors are. In your mind, what is the color scheme? So, you know, I just kind of made stuff up on the spot.
I remember seeing the mail-in ads for the Ninja Turtles miniatures way, 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 way back in the day. I wonder, like, how many of those survive to this day?
The ads or the miniatures?
No, the minis.
Oh, God, yeah. Who knows?
Yeah. Yeah, I would think not that many. I actually had a few, but they were stolen over the years.
Oof.
But they were cool. Dark Horse Miniatures. No relationship to the comic book company.
Really? None?
Yeah. Huh. Nope. Nice guy. He was actually involved in munitions. And just kind of started doing miniatures,
yeah,
you know, on the side.
So the Ninja Turtles comics, you had just finished issue two, and that's pretty awesome. When the Ninja Turtles Kickstarter was going on, we released a series of episodes where we were diving into doing deep reads, going back through the entire product line, and it was fascinating as a fan of the comics, rereading these books and being like, oh, that's right. There were only like four comics out at this point. Because you can follow along in the game with the comics that are coming out at the same time. Like the Adventures, I think, was only up to like issue 3 or 4. And then you've got all the stuff with the Triceratons. And then you've got the stuff with the Utroms. And it's all just sort of following along. And it's just, it's a very nice time capsule of awesomeness.
It really is. Yeah. And I'll tell you, you know, looking at the art again, it's just, those guys were so good, Kevin and Pete. Mm-hmm. I mean, think about it. I mean, Kevin Eastman was 24. Peter Laird was 30 or 32. It was their first real black and white venture. I mean, and it's beautiful. Their storytelling is crisp and clean. The action is fantastic. I mean, it really did kind of capture that Jack Kirby, Frank Miller kind of feel. And it's beautiful. What those guys created is just unbelievably good.
Yeah. Damn.
Well, you mentioned early issues. So a funny story for me, and I've told it here and there, but one day I'm talking. So originally I started talking to Peter Laird, and then I started talking more to Kevin Eastman. And one day I'm talking to Kev, we're just having a good conversation about stuff. And all of a sudden he says, oh my God, I got to go. It's starting to rain. And I'm like, it's raining. So what? And he's like, you don't understand. Issue number 3 is in the driveway. We got to get it in the garage.
Oh, and I'm God.
Like, go, go.
Well, I'm glad it was saved because it was a good issue.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah. I remember back in the day. Well, okay, all of this is back in the day. I keep saying that, but we've talked about this before too. Rifter number 9, I think it was 9, where that cover of the Ninja Turtles is on it. Yep. And there's that really, really long message from you about how the license was ending largely because of the confusion with the cartoon and how one was sort of supplanting the other. That was truly sad because you were totally right. Like everything was moving away from this grittier black and white and red style towards this sort of, you know, breakfast cereal style of storytelling. I don't really know where I was going to go with that. It was just a sad. It was so sad looking at that happening.
Well, it was for us too. You know, that was a great Simon Beasley cover. That was supposed to be the cover to a new release. Mm-hmm. Of the RPG. We were going to do an updated version, and Eric was going to work on it, and I was going to work on it, and Kevin Eastman got us Simon Beasley, which was amazing, and we actually had a bunch of art done by Paulo Parente and a few other people, and I just sat back, and you know, they didn't want a fortune. Their agent didn't want a fortune for the license, but it was a fair chunk of change. And we just sat back and went, I don't know if we're going to make a significant amount of money beyond, you know, the licensing fee. And, you know, I thought we could get people back into it. But at the time, it had gotten what I call kiddified. Yeah. I mean, it just... And the thing is, you can argue that, well, what's changed today? Well, what changed today is you have like 3 generations of Turtle fans. And so you have people who, in different iterations of the Turtles. So you have Turtle comics that are for a more adult audience. You have Turtle comics for sort of an in-between audience. You have Turtle comics and cartoons and movies for youngsters. But back then, it had gone from this gritty alternative comic book to the equivalent of Mickey Mouse. And our primary audience was kids 12 to, you know, 32. And, you know, it just no self-respecting high school kid or college kid wanted to play Mickey Mouse.
Yeah.
You know, and it was as simple as that. I mean, we just saw our sales plummet. I mean, at the peak anticipation for that first movie, we had shot up to like 4,500 copies a month of just the basic core rule book. And then after that movie hit and the toy line hit and the new cartoon came out, and we just saw it just plummet. I mean, we went from, you know, 4,400 copies to like 2,500 copies to, you know, 1,500 copies. I mean, every month it just was this gigantic drop. And when the dust cleared like a year or so later, we were only selling like 200-300 copies a month, which, you know, wasn't awful, but it just wasn't great. And we could see it continuing to slide. You know, the source books had you know, practically stopped selling entirely. And it just felt like it was time to let it go. I wish I hadn't, you know, in retrospect, I wish we had kept it. But, you know, if we hadn't, you know, let it go, we wouldn't have this cool Kickstarter that means so much to everybody.
Well, as you were saying, three generations, maybe more, of Turtles fans now, this sudden onset of this Kickstarter coming out of nowhere, bringing this game back, reminding people, oh, yeah, those comics were awesome. And that it exploded in a way that if you hadn't given up that license, it probably wouldn't have. Yeah. So yeah, I guess hindsight, you know, and
it's, 2020. It's beautiful to revisit it. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
That was it. Hindsight. It's 2020, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. One thing that I always liked about the role-playing game versus the cartoon was that even though that I was a young child at the time and I was a big fan of the cartoon, I liked that the role-playing game was loyal to the contents of the comics, including characters. Like, the cartoon had April O'Neil and Baxter Stockman and Casey Jones, but they were very different. Oh, Casey was fairly actually on point, but April, totally different character. Baxter, totally different character. And going back to the comics and the role-playing game and seeing the original characters there and their original focus, and you're like, wow, it's one of those things where I guess folks, you had to be there, you know, you had to have appreciated them at the time to realize how truly inspirational they were and how the cartoon, for everything that it was worth and all the good that it did, it could have done better.
Well, yeah, you know, it's kind of weird because you look at it and I mean, could they have done better? Could it have been different? Sure. Could it have been more like Batman? Sure. But I'll tell you, you know, because I've thought about that because, you know, I was obviously a big fan of the comic book and Kevin Eastman and Peter Laird's work. And, you know, it definitely, you know, when it went to the mass market, it was aimed at a younger audience. You know, largely because toys was the big push. And, you know, their target market was, you know, ages 4 to 8. And they did a great job nailing that, you know, and the cartoon reflected that. But here's the thing. We all love Ninja Turtles, whatever version or every version that you may love. Think about it. It's one of the few intellectual properties that certainly everyone in the Western world knows. I mean, you can say Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles to a grandma, a little kid, a teenager, guys your age, everybody. I mean, when I'm trying to explain what we do to bankers and accountants and attorneys and whatever, it's always confusing. But you say Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, they're instantly on board. They instantly know what it is. Mm-hmm. That's phenomenal. And had Mark Friedman not taken it in that direction, would it be that big? Would it be Spider-Man? Would it be Superman? Because that's what it is. Everybody knows the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. And that's pretty amazing because not only do they know it, but they love it. People love those turtles.
Mm-hmm. They loved them at the time too. And it was a clearly a runaway success, so much that it immediately spawned parodies. I remember I had a couple of issues of something called Adolescent Radioactive Kung Fu Hamsters. There were several others at the time, but I just remember like collecting these things.
Yeah, I have that comic as well.
Oh, nice. I've never spoken to another person who remembers that one. So,
oh, yeah, absolutely. It wasn't terrible. It was pretty good. But it was clearly a ripoff of the TMNT.
Yeah. And also, what's fascinating is we talked about this way back on the first time we had you on to talk about Ninja Turtles, that Netflix show The Toys That Made Us.
Yes.
Well, it's a later episode of the Netflix of that same series that focuses on the Mighty Morphin Power Rangers, which is another one of those four words thing, which wouldn't have come into existence if it weren't for the Turtles. And then later, the Turtles would show up on the Mighty Morphin Power Rangers. And you're like, it has come full circle.
Yeah, it's crazy. But it's cool. And in looking back at it, I don't know how, why it resonated with me the way it did. And, you know, why I instantly saw something that was worth licensing. I mean, come on. It's issue number two of a black and white comic book. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. Just something said, yeah, this will be great. And, you know, we did it. And, you know, I think our success in part was that we were so loyal to the original material, right down to getting Kevin Eastman and Peter Laird to do all the original art for it, to do a brand new 8 or 10 page comic strip for it. That was all planned. That was all me. That was all me trying to be calculating and create a role-playing game that comic book fans would recognize and want to buy. That's why the original price for it was $10, $9.95, because I figured, well, you know, that's around the price of one of these newfangled graphic novels, you know, because graphic novels were new at the time. And I thought, yeah, you know, we give them enough cool looking Eastman and Laird art and we capture that comic book feel and comic book fans will want it. And it did. I mean, it got us into mom and pop comic book shops all over the place. You know, that and Robotech the very next year, it was like that 1-2 punch. And, you know, we became a staple in comic book stores for like the next, you know, 15 years.
So Ninja Turtles would be the second license. I'm guessing Justice Machine was the first one.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah, I always say there's only three reasons to get a license.
Yeah.
And any one of those three reasons is good enough. And in our case, with both Ninja Turtles and Robotech, it was, one, we think it's going to make us a lot of money. Two, it's going to open up doors for us. And three, and arguably the most important, in my view, you love it. You love the IP. Because I think it really helps to be a passion project.
Yeah.
And you know, my philosophy, and Sean's is this way too, and so was Eric Woodjick, is, you know, we want to take that comic property and bring it into a new medium. We don't want to make it ours. We don't want to make it something different. We want to take that world and bring it to life in a new medium as loyally as possible. And I think we nailed that. And that's why it was so hugely popular. I mean, to the point where I am shocked. I never realized until we did this Kickstarter and talked to so many people who loved the role-playing game and loved the comic books. I am floored by how many people discovered the role-playing game first and then the comic books.
Were they Palladium fans initially who just migrated to the next property, or were they people who were just at the store, saw this thing, Ninja Turtles?
Yeah, I think it was a combination of the two. Yeah, it's crazy.
You told me a story on one of our phone calls that if we can't tell this on the air, let me know. But I thought it amusing that I wanted to bring it up just in case. How much trouble did you get in for sending those postcards out during the Kickstarter?
Oh, the flyer?
Yeah.
Well, you know, we needed to get everything pre-approved, and I was just so excited to get things out, to get the word out, that you know, Wayne Smith and I threw together this really great flyer that was part of, you know, part of it was the official press release, and part of it was new insight and stuff. And yeah, I mean, Paramount was not happy that I did that. And, you know, I apologized. I mean, everything should get approved first. I mean, it just, but, you know, Paramount's been really cool to work with. So they were just kind of like, well, don't do it again. You know, got to do this the right way. And I'm like, thank you. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. I won't do it. But people loved it. I mean, I think it helped make it look real, which it is. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to have that in their hands, you know, most people, you know, comments we kept hearing from our supporters and backers was that, holy crap, I got this in the mail. I don't know any other Kickstarter who has ever done this. And that's why we did it. I mean, I used to be the master of print ads. So I knew it had cachet, and I knew people didn't do it anymore. And I thought people would really stand up and take notice of it, which they did. Which was good, even if I got in some trouble.
Questions, Jacob?
Yeah, no. At this point, it's like you covered the one, because I was going to ask about the flyer that went out, because I got super jazzed when it showed up in my mailbox, and I was like, oh, this is... I know my way around IP law well enough to know, like, I smell a problem.
It was very nice really receiving that. Yes, though.
It
was surprised.
Yeah,
like, just wow.
Yeah. On our Discord server, people were like popping off, going like, "I got mine! Oh my god!"
And of course, there was never before seen art in that flyer.
Yep.
Well, it was art that we had seen, but we had never before seen it color.
Yes. Yep. Exactly. Yeah. The Terror Bears, even though it was a postage stamp sized image, it was very crisp and clean and beautiful. And some of the other art. Yeah, absolutely. And it's, you know, that's sort of Playdium's trademark, or at least, you know, one of my underlining themes is I want to surprise our customer base. I want people to go wow over our products. And that was a way to deliver a little bit of wow factor.
So the books that we've already mentioned were more or less following the release of the comics. From my opinion, as a fan, as a player of the game, it felt like each one was building upon the success of the previous one, incorporating more, becoming a better and a smoother and a more awesome product. And then it all came to Transdimensional TMNT, which... you've probably heard this many times. It's one of the most awesome books ever made. Like, the concepts of time travel and just the patterning of the way time and dimensions work with each other is one of the only, in my opinion, functional systems of time travel I've ever seen in a role-playing game.
I agree 100%. I'm not a time travel fan. Especially in games. And that's 100% Eric Wujek. And I read it and I'm like, Eric, this is great. You know, thank you for doing this. And like I said, it was 100, that book is 100% Eric Wujek.
Wow. And still, there were only like, what, 10, 12 issues out at that time. So, so much of that just came out of his head. Like, how closely was he working with Kevin and Peter, or was he just largely like, were they just like, do what you want, man?
They were pretty do what you want. I mean, you know, the initial game, you know, the RPG, they were more closely involved, but I think we won them over. I mean, it's great stuff. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I kind of remember Pete saying, well, Kevin, you're the experts in this field. You do whatever you think is necessary. And as long as it fits with our comic book lore, we're good. So that's pretty much what we did.
Wow. That's just madness. Like the turning something over that you have created that has made you, I mean, well, you and the general you, them really, but were they millionaires by this point? Like, had it really taken off or was that?
No, I mean, they were a comic book phenomenon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, I don't think they get the credit they deserve for having started the black and white independent comic book craze. Mm-hmm. Them and a few other comics really struck a nerve and really launched things. But no, they were like, hey, we can make a living at this. How awesome is that? That's where they were kind of at. And then they wouldn't be millionaires until the early 1990s, mm-hmm. late 1980. In fact, I want to say it was 1990 where I was telling Kevin Pete, wow, guys, this is fantastic. You guys must be making millions and millions. And they're like, well, the funny thing about that is on paper, we're worth millions, but we haven't actually gotten like more than one small royalty check. And that would obviously change, you know, a year or so later. But no, they were just struggling artists and creators who had a lot of great ideas.
Yeah, I remember when that movie came out, and I want to say it was 1990 because it was, you know, Jim Henson Studios making Ninja Turtles. Mm-hmm. You're like, what is my world coming to right now? And just... It was darker. It had darker themes. It had actual characters fighting because, you know, cartoons, they run around and they've got weapons and maybe G.I. Joe's got guns, but no one who isn't a robot ever gets hit with one of those weapons or guns. It's always very, you know, implied, but they never show the violence. And then finally the movie comes around and you're like, this is what I have wanted. So I just being able to take that home and now roll some dice and here's some official rules for how I can do that. And I can play out all of those scenes that very, very closely mirror the comics in a really cool way.
Well, that was the crazy thing. When I got the license, I knew exactly what the game needed to be. And that guy who had called me and said, hey, you should make the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle role-playing game. I gave him the first shot at writing the game, and only seemed fair. He was excited. I was excited. And, you know, meanwhile, you know, Eric and I, we were at a point in our lives where I was one of these people who worked through the night. My kids would go to sleep around 8 o'clock because they were little. And then my wife would go to sleep around 11 and that's when my work day really kind of began, 11 o'clock at night. And Eric was working a job where he had to do some computer stuff at the Detroit News. And then once he had gotten certain machines going or calibrated or whatever the hell he did, he basically had like 5 hours of just sitting there with nothing to do. I mean, he would read, he'd make notes and write things. And so I would give him a call around midnight or 12:30, and we would talk for 2 or 3 hours almost every night. So I told Eric about the Ninja Turtles and how cool this comic was. And I got him hooked on it. And then he and I kept talking about, you know, what should be in the game. Cause I'm like, it's got to have, you know, the rules to create any type of mutant animal. It's got to have animal powers, you know, maybe psionics. You know, and there's a lot of different elements. And Eric and I used to love to just spitball ideas and brainstorm, even if it went nowhere. It would drive my wife crazy because, you know, Eric would come over and we'd talk, you know, in the basement or in my office or outside for 4 hours. And I'd come back in and she goes like, so did you work out whatever it is you guys were you know, for this current book? And I'm like, oh, no. What, did you talk about X, Y, and Z? No. And she's like, well, what the hell were you talking about all this time? And it's like, oh, this or that. And she's like, so is that like for a new book? No.
D- Do you, as a creative person, Kevin, find, or maybe did at this time, that your ideas suddenly start hitting you at like 10 o'clock at night? Like, you've spent all day doing whatever it is that you do, maybe doing some writing, maybe doing some organizing, and then you're maybe laying in bed, and then suddenly 10 o'clock, eyes open. I really need to write this down.
Well, yeah, I mean, that was sort of my routine. So yeah, I started to, you know, get antsy around 10 or so because work time is coming. Mm-hmm. And I would jump into it and have fun writing till 5 or 6 in the morning. And the kids and my wife would be getting up to go to work and go to school, and I'd be going to bed and, and then I'd get up around noon and write for 2 or 3 hours, and the kids would come home and I could play Mr. Mom until Marianne came home from work around 5:30 or 6. And, work being Palladium, she ran the office and stuff back then. And it worked out really well. Yeah, but, you know, really, again, ideas, you know, come at the craziest times. I mean, I got some of my best ideas in the frickin' shower or driving home. You know, it's like I always had a notepad with me wherever I was because I got to write this down. But, you take it where you can get it.
There's a mechanic in Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, which I've never seen in another of the Palladium games. And correct me if I've just missed it, but that is the teamwork, team creation mechanic. And it's an extremely simple, yet very awesome, extensible, elegant mechanic, mm-hmm. which is very simple. If your group has a lot of the same things in common, you all start one level higher. Mm-hmm. It's beautiful. Mm-hmm. That it explains so much in such a simple way that, you know, someone can come to sit down at your table and you're explaining the systems to them and you're like, oh yeah, well, I guess we've got some history. Does that come into play? Like, maybe we should get a bonus. And you're like, you already do. You're a level higher because of your teamwork.
And it's a level higher per member.
It's beautiful.
It was one of those mechanics that I saw it for the first time and went, this just makes sense. Mm-hmm. It's appropriate to the setting material. It's appropriate to the genre. It's mechanically simple, you know, just so good.
Yeah. There was a lot of wonderful simplicity in that was deceptively simple, mm-hmm. but also deeply complex in these games.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that was Eric, mm-hmm. you know, one of the things that I always want to do, and Eric always likes to do, and Sean's this way too. We try to, again, bring that world to life. And so we sat back and went, these guys are a family. These guys are team members. How do we put that team aspect, you know, give it some oomph, make it important, make it something you want to play? And that was Eric's solution, and I loved it. As did you. So,
yeah. Mm-hmm. So, Kevin, do you have a favorite character that you played in a Ninja Turtles game?
As a game master, I tend to play the bad guys. So,
I think Jacob and I can both sympathize with that.
Yeah. I think we may have 3 lifer game masters on this call. Yep. Yeah.
So in that regard, Doc Farrell was my go-to villain. I love that guy.
Yeah.
But, I mean, the Terror Bears were great. I think that was Eric's favorite.
Oh, and the Terror Bears. Oh, my God. what you did with them, not only in the first book, but what was done with them throughout mm-hmm. the books. And even, I'm going to reference a future topic here, even into After the Bomb.
Well, using them in the Adventures book, using them as the potential creation for the entire After the Bomb scenario was
wonderful. Yeah. You know. And so complex in so many ways. I mean, perfect for the material you were pulling from, and especially at that time for when it came out, front running complex NPCs in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. Yeah. In very effectively. It's like one of the parts that I always go to as like, if you want to create a quote unquote good villain, they're one of the ones I go look at what was done with these characters, because if you're looking to do a good villain in the role-playing game, just go through the TMNT books and look what's done with the Terror Bears.
They're solid.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I would tend to concur. I think that was Eric. So one of the things Eric was convinced that I created the best villains he had ever seen anyone run in role-playing. And I don't know about that. I mean, I'll take it. I love villains, but I think that was Eric trying to up his game and create some really memorable villains, and he knocked it out of the park.
Yeah. Was Doc Farrell his too?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you know offhand what the true colors of Doc Farrell's outfit are?
We must establish the canon. Kevin, give me the canon.
Yeah, it's like Dr. Scrubs, right? I mean, it's like that teal-ish.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh my God, I wonder how much Harlan Ellison's miniature collection would sell for.
Oh, yeah.
Ooh. If it even still exists.
Yeah.
He seemed like the kind of guy who would have just rooms and rooms full of things that he's collected over the years. Because he was very much a hands-on physical medium kind of guy, you know? Wow. I got to look that up. Yeah, I can relate to that. Yeah.
Yeah, his estate, though, is a little bit of a mess, so who knows how it ended up.
Yeah.
Yeah, but like one of those, you know, luminaries you don't think about being into miniatures or gaming or anything like that. Like the day I learned that Robin Williams was actually a huge Warhammer fan, you know, it's like one of those moments when Kevin told me that Harlan Ellison wanted the exact right colors to paint his miniatures. This is going to stick in my head.
Yeah.
Well, it is funny how many celebs, you know, I think we just don't think of you know, movie stars and writers and other creators being into our little niche hobby.
Yeah, yeah.
But they are, and they love it. And I'm amazed at how many people have been inspired by role playing in my games, and mm-hmm. you know, our the foreword to the RPG Redux edition is by Ross and Marshall Thurber, mm-hmm. which is a big up and coming writer, director guy. I mean, he wrote Red Notice wrote and directed Red Notice for Netflix, which was the most watched original movie ever presented by Netflix. You know, he's done a bunch of other good, fun stuff before that. And, you know, when I met him, he's like, Kev, it was playing Ninja Turtles and riffs that made me realize I want to be a writer, producer, you know, director, because I love telling stories. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, wow.
This goes back to a conversation NPC and I were having literally less than a week ago.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
It was. So that does raise an interesting question in my mind. We've talked before about how you seem to have a bit of a talent for networking. You know, the strong, you know, not hearing the no and all of that. So who's the most interesting person you've ever game mastered for?
Oh, I'm sure Eric had game masters a lot more. You want to
talk about
a networker. Eric Woodjick was just like, he knew everybody on the flipping planet. I mean, seriously. I mean, he made so much money on the Ninja Turtle books that he quit his job and went wandering around Europe
mm-hmm.
for like 2 or 3 years. I called him the Johnny Appleseed of gaming. He would just, hi, I'm Eric Woodchick. It's nice to meet you guys. Why don't you put me up in your house and I'll run games all week. and people would. And he did.
That's awesome.
And so I had the pleasure of meeting Eric once. And it wasn't in a convention setting or anything. he just happened to be in the city I happen to be living in, Duluth, Minnesota. I don't even recall he mentioned it, but why he was there, but he was there. And your description of how he introduces himself is 100% accurate. I am honestly surprised that an impromptu gaming session didn't break out in the coffee shop we were sitting in. It was that close. Oh, you like ninjas and super spies and TMNT.
Yeah.
No, he I used to say he was a true bohemian and just a kind of larger than life figure. I mean, for those who have not met Eric Woodjick, if you ever seen the movie or the play Fiddler on the Roof, Eric basically was Tevye. Yeah, he very much looked like that. And in his younger days, he always had like this leather fisherman's cap that bushy beard and soup strainer mustache. And he was just happy. You know, he was just always happy to meet people and talk about gaming or science fiction or movies or comic books or history or politics. I mean, he just was one of those guys. And I'm a decent networker. I think I'm sort of a networker despite myself, because I'm a bit more shy. Not that you can tell these days, but especially in my youth. You know, I think guys like Eric Woodjick and Alex Marcinison help pull me out of that. So, but yeah, you know, I mean, I don't know if I can just walk up to anybody and just strike up a conversation like Eric could.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, being able to mix and mingle was definitely from the feel from the one encounter I got his strong suit. But, you know, it differs. People are different that way. Some people are great connectors because they can walk into a room and make friends with everybody there. Some people are good because, well, maybe that doesn't come naturally to them. They're good at forging long working relationships. And, you know, so I can see how you two were probably one heck of a team.
Oh, yeah. We were. We were. I guess we were pretty amazing. There was this one time where, and I wish to hell I had the tape. I mean, doesn't have to be edited or anything. There was some gentleman who was putting together what he hoped to be a series of DVDs, or it might even have been VHS at the time. I don't remember. I think it was DVDs, which would be like these interviews with creators. At the time, there were a series of them coming out for Comic Book Guys. It was like a Todd McFarlane and Stan Lee and some other things. And I think the guy was inspired by that. And he was going to do the same thing for gaming. Of course, Eric Woodjick runs into this guy and convinces him. And the guy was pretty much done with his series, I think. And Eric, of course, convinces him, "No, you got to come and do an interview with me and Kev. You got to meet Kevin. Have you met Kevin? You got to meet Kevin." And so the guy comes to the Platinum offices, and we're supposed to be like his last interviews, I think. And he interviews Eric, and then he interviews me, and then he brings us in together. And there's some point where Eric and I are just going, and this guy's like suddenly like, "Wait, wait, wait! Oh my God, I ran out of tape! Hold on! I mean, you guys are phenomenal! I mean, you guys are great one-on-one, but together, I've never seen anything like it—the electricity!" And Eric and I just kind of look at each other and kind of shrug, and we're like, "Yeah, I guess so." And I would love to see those tapes so I could see it, because you know, you never know how other people kind of perceive you or how you come across to others. Not really. You just can't know. And I would love to see what that electricity, you know, looked like. Cause this guy sure seemed to think he had captured it on tape. So, but, we were a pretty great team and best friends, man. I mean, just, we loved each other to death and, it was great. Well, Jacob, I'm glad you got a chance to meet Eric.
Yeah, I mean, it just so happened, like, I don't even know why I recognized him. Because, like, this was the 90s, and I just happened to be back in town at that point. and I just stumbled onto the same little coffee shop he and some people were hanging out at, having lunch. And I just walked up and went, "Hey, I just want to say I'm a big fan of your work, because like I don't tend to be one of those fanboy people who gush. It's just like, hey, I want to just show my appreciation and let you get back to your day-to-day life."
Yeah, I'm the same way.
You know,
yep.
It's like I treat people the way I generally want to be treated in that regard. And he went, "Oh, which piece of my work?" And the dams blew up. So there used to be a turn of phrase that was common amongst the RPG community up in the Arrowhead region of Minnesota. It was being a dice in the pocket guy. Uh-huh. One of those people who walked around with a full set of dice in your pocket, ready to game at the drop of the hat. And it was very clear that Eric was 100% one of those. Like I said, I am still stunned we didn't have a impromptu gaming session right there in the middle of the coffee shop.
Nope, that was Eric for sure.
Yeah, no, I mean, I ended up having a very interesting, wide-ranging conversation with him because, you know, like the one thing, I don't know if this was his normal behavior, but in our conversation, he really wanted to know what I liked about each game. And so we got into this super in-depth conversation about real world martial arts versus RPG martial arts and that sort of thing. So it was,
Well, no, we like to get, you know, that's the thing is people's input. I mean, we're writing for you guys.
Right.
So I think any good writer, and certainly Eric, and especially game designers, you need to know what your audience likes. You need to know what really resonates with them. So, yeah, when we ask those kind of questions, we definitely mean it. We definitely want to know, and we definitely are listening, because that's the only way you learn what your audience wants, and whether you're hitting or missing. Mm-hmm. You know, it's you always got to be critical of your own work. So, I'm not surprised. Plus, you know, it's also about game theory.
Mm-hmm.
Getting your feedback tells us, I nailed that. That was what I was trying to achieve, and I nailed it. Or, I was trying to achieve this, but clearly he missed it, and I must have gotten something wrong. How can I fix that in the next game?
Yeah.
That was Eric. And then, you know, I think one of the things Eric and I had in common was, you know, we're passionate about what we do, and what you see is what you get. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just, you know, that there's no facade, there's no let's play games, there's no "Hi, I'm Kevin Sabita or Eric Woodjick," you know, "and you're just a lowly fanboy." You know, there's none of that.
None of that.
It's, you know, you're one of us, is how we look at things.
So turning back to TMNT for a minute, I have a question. Were sales just continually going up and up with each new book you released? Or did they start to taper out before you finally decided to put that product line to bed due to the, you know, brand confusion and other things?
It was taking off. In fact, you know, Palladium Books was just sort of this steady meteor going up and up and up. We were at our peak. I think we were growing like 30% a year.
Jesus. So,
No, it was crazy. I know if you're growing like 6 or 8%, it's like, good job. And yeah, we were doing between 20% and 30% for like the first 12 years. We just kept, you know, going up. But I mean, think about it. We had good things going of Palladium Fantasy. We had good things going of Heroes Unlimited. And then we get Ninja Turtles. And then we get Robotech. And then we have Ninjas and Super Spies. We fool around with stuff like Beyond the Supernatural. And then Rifts.
Mm-hmm.
And plus we had the Robotech videotapes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was just, man, we were just taking off. And there was like no stopping us.
I mean, you had a role-playing game where I could make a mutant cassowary.
Yes. So, I mean,
of course, it's amazing. Good time.
of all of the TMNT books, not counting the After the Bomb, but just the TMNT and other Strangeness books, which is your favorite?
Obviously, it's sort of split between the RPG mm-hmm. and Transdimensional TMNT.
Yep, that makes total sense. The writing there is some of the tightest I've ever mm-hmm. seen in an RPG. I mean, the main book. You did so much with so little a page count.
Mm-hmm. So much is happening there. And there's all those adventures in the back, and it's wonderful.
And great game. I'm going to do a little bit of a geek out on layout on that one, just because they're... You're probably going to burst a bubble for me here that I've been living in this little delusion for the last several decades. But there seemed to be a lot of intentionality on the art choices that were put on each specific page throughout that one.
Oh, no, absolutely. That was all deliberate. And the layout was all me. And one of the things that still drives me crazy when I see it, you don't see it quite as much nowadays, but you still see a lot of it, is role-playing games where here's this character or NPC, and here's this cool piece of art, and you're like, wow, what is that? Mm-hmm. It's a cool piece of art. Yep. The end. Yep. It has no purpose in the book other than it's you know, might as well be a border or mm-hmm. you know, some other graphic, because it's just this pretty picture, and that drove me crazy. And for me, I think it comes from my comic book background. Story and art, they're integral, and you want them to work together. And when they work together, it tells a bigger, stronger story. And so when you read about the Terror Bears and you look at that art, you go, whoa, you know, as opposed to nothing or just, you know, a pretty picture that has no meaning. You know, that's very deliberate. That's something I've tried to do with my books from the very beginning.
Yeah, that's one, you know, that's potentially, if I was to name, this is Kevin's layout magnum opus. That might be the book, because, you know, I was looking through it the other day in preparation for this episode, and like, there's no piece of art that just seems to be good for the page. It's like every piece of art in that book is perfect for the page it's on.
Like, one of my favorite pieces, and by the way, one of Joe Manganiello's favorite pieces, is that transition from dog to human.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, let's give credit to Eastman and Laird. I mean, I would tell them what I want, and those two guys would just freaking nail it.
Absolutely. So,
you know, it helps if you have a great talent that you're working with.
So let's discuss that process a little bit, because they did do a lot of original artwork for TMNT. And what was the back and forth like with them? You'd tell them what they want. They send it to you. First time out of the box was smack on, or was it a more collaborative process where they came back to you and went, well, can you give us a little bit more on what you need here or there? Or how'd that go?
Again, I think we were pretty simpatico, and they were pretty excited about it. We would mostly talk a lot about it and talk about what we're trying to convey and what this character should be. Like, Doc Farrell's a great example of, you know, we wanted him to be sort of a Dr. Frankenstein type, where he's this mad genius creating these wild creatures. But so we wanted to show him and show him kind of aloof. And then we wanted a couple of his henchmen, you know, mutant animal henchmen, and this crazy lab. And again, Kevin Pete just freaking nailed it. I don't think there were any pieces that we sent back to them. So we would talk about what we wanted and the atmosphere we wanted. And then they would send me a pencil sketch sometimes, and sometimes they'd go just direct to a tight pencil, and they would send me photocopies. Mm-hmm. In fact, some of those will be appearing in the books, on the Redux editions, where you get to see their pencil work. And in fact, I also have a cool note from Peter Laird, written in like red Sharpie, talking about the assignment. And here it is. I hope you like it. Sorry, we're a little late or whatever. And I don't know. I think because I'm so into what we do, and I'm so into the artists, if that makes sense, because mm-hmm. I mean, I love this kind of stuff. And you sometimes hear movie directors referred to as an actor's director. Mm-hmm. Well, I think me and nowadays Sean, we're sort of artist publishers. Mm-hmm. I mean, we nurture our writers and our artists, and we appreciate them. So there was one point where Kevin Eastman, we're having a nice chat, and he goes, "So Kev, here's the thing we don't understand." And I'm like, "What's that?" He goes, "We feel like we're doing our best work for you." And I'm like, "Great." And they're like, no, shouldn't we be doing our best work for ourselves? We can't explain it. I mean, can you explain it? And I'm like, I don't know. But I think, I think some of my enthusiasm is kind of contagious. And I get people really revved up and into it and loving what they're doing and excited about the project and themselves. And, you know, a happy artist is going to give you their best work.
Yeah.
I think it's kind of as simple as that. So we got some of their best work out of them.
You brought up Doc Farrell. And Doc Farrell brings up the, like, one bone I have to pick with you.
Uh-oh.
Y'all managed to create a character that has put me in the position of having to explain what vivisection is more times than any other thing in my life. And then have people get mad at me because of what vivisection is.
I don't know what to say. I'm sorry.
No, that's more funny than anything. It was just like that every single time. It got to the point where if I introduced someone new to TMNT and they read the book, I knew they were going to be coming back going like, "What's vivisection?" Because they knew I know.
I know that we are approaching the time that you would like to leave, Kevin. Do you have any other stories that you want to tell that we haven't already had?
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, there's probably a million of them. Yeah. You know, it's not RPG super specific, but it's certainly turtle related. So, and I talk about this in the history of the Redux edition, just because as a dad, it's just a fun story. So, you know, my kids were immersed in what we were doing. And so, of course, they knew about Turtles, and they were reading comics and enjoying them. And like, this is probably 1987 and maybe 88, but probably 87. And my daughter, who's like 10 years old, says, "I want to go out trick-or-treating as Leonardo." And we're like, "Awesome." Well, bear in mind, this is before the cartoons, before the mm-hmm. movies, before the toys.
Oh, wow.
So,
right. You get where this is going. So she makes this amazing costume with the help of her mom and me. She has this beautiful turtle shell that she can wear, made out of paper mache.
Oh.
She's got these two wooden swords we got at the Renaissance Festival. She's wearing a skull cap, and she's, you know, body painted everything. She looks fantastic. And every, and I mean every single house she goes up to, they say, "And what are you supposed to be?" And you know, they've got this incredulous look on like, "What the heck?" Mm-hmm. And she proudly announces, "I'm a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle, Leonardo." And they're like, "What?" I'm a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle, Leonardo. And they're like, okay, have some candy. And, you know, poor Monica is getting worn out, you know, every house she goes to. It's kind of like the same thing. And finally, she's like, why don't these people know who the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles are?
And then a few years down the road over the breakfast table, they're going, hey, you remember that one kid who showed up at
Halloween? I often wonder, do they? Or was it totally forgotten? Because, yeah, 2 years later, half the frickin' kids are dressed up as one turtle or another.
Right.
And, yeah, it makes me wonder. I wish I had photos. I tried to find photos, but I think they've been lost over the ages because we took a bunch of photos of her. She looked great. Yeah, 2 years later, the whole world would know who the Ninja Turtles are, but not that Halloween. Poor kid.
So, Kevin, we're coming to the end of our time. Is there anything you want to plug? Well, any upcoming announcements from Palladium Books, anything related to the Kickstarter, anything at all?
Well, backers, like 80% of our backers for the TMNT and Other Strangeness Kickstarter have filled out their survey and adjusted their pledge. That still leaves 20% of people out there that we need you to do soon. We're probably shutting down the pledge manager in the middle of April. So the sooner you guys can get us that, the better. We have a ton of art that's being approved. Or has been approved. We're kind of waiting on some of that. We're waiting for the fabled Kevin Eastman finished color, cover painting.
Seriously, I'm so excited
the guy is so busy.
Yeah.
You know, I've been hearing Friday for like the last 8 weeks now.
Yeah.
So no slam on Kev because he's awesome and amazing and we appreciate what he's doing. Mm-hmm. But you know, we just haven't been able to show that yet. And we wanted to show a bunch of other stuff with it. We got the mutagen green dice. They're beautiful. They're everything I wanted them to be. Sean did a great job conveying that to the manufacturer. They look great.
These are the ones that have the goo in the side?
Yeah.
How do they roll?
They roll really nice.
Okay.
Really nice. In fact, I was making jokes earlier because we were on a conference call first with Paramount and then with our social media guy, Chris Landauer. And I just kept rolling him and rolling him, I think, to the annoyance of Sean. And I'm like, I can't help it. They're addictive. I just like looking at them. Because just the way the fluid inside has got like this sparkle and almost like when a die stops, it's like, it's kind of almost like a snow globe where you have this like poof.
Ooh.
And then you see it kind of settling down and it almost looks like it's kind of like boiling. Mm-hmm. And just the way the light hits it, I love it. I love it. So I'm really happy with that. Everything's coming together like crazy. I guess the thing I would like to plug, if this goes up in time, and please don't feel obligated to rush NPC, but we have what we're calling our big GM's Day sale. Mm-hmm. It coincides with the drive-through RPG GM's Day's sale, which we missed. We were so busy, we didn't even realize it was happening. But we still want to do our sale of physical books. So that's going on right now to at least Tuesday or Wednesday. And, it's 30% savings. So it's a good time to buy. It covers a whole bunch of main titles and good stuff from most of our game lines. And other than that, you know, keep the faith. We are busting our backs to get things done. We got all kinds of stuff we can't talk about, some really exciting things. Mm-hmm. Another possible license that we didn't expect would be, we just didn't expect. So, and it's not, it hasn't happened yet. So
okay,
but yep. we're in talks.
Yep.
So we're pretty excited about that. You know, I've been doing a lot of art lately. I'm doing some of the art for the Redux edition.
Oh, nice.
And I got two tribute pages that have been approved. And then Sophie Campbell is going to color one of them and probably Mike Majestic the other one. Yeah. Yeah. Sophie's a huge fan and we've gotten pretty tight. So I didn't even think of it. I didn't want to bother. I know she's really swamped. And Jeff Whitman at Paramount said, have you offered this to Sophie? And we're like, ah, she's so busy. And he's like, no, I think you should really offer this to her, 'cause I think she'd want to do it. 'Cause it's my homage page to Trans D. So, and she's a big, huge fan of Transdimensional TMNT also. So I reached out to her and she's like, yes, I would love to. Yeah, we just sent it to her this afternoon. But everything's looking good. Everything's moving along. We got all kinds of great stuff happening. You know, a bunch of our regular books are moving along. Riff's Bestiary and...
I'm so excited to get that. That first one was so good. It's so good.
Good, good. Yeah. I think you'll be happy with this.
Yeah. It's another one of those books that, just a side note, listeners, if you haven't had the Bestiary one, it's another one of those books that if you listen to us long enough, you know I like books that ooze with content. Like every single page of that is just full of ideas of things to do. It's one of my favorite Riffs books of all time. Anyway, back to you, Kevin.
Thanks. And then, those lines, Sophie is just reading Riff's Coalition Manhunters now. Mm-hmm. And she was, you know, freaking out about how good that book was, because she hadn't read it yet, and she's incorporating a bunch of stuff into her game. She plays every weekend, nice. A couple different games, and she's like, oh my God, this book is so good. And I'm like, thanks. I think it's one of the best things I've ever written. And she said, I agree. So that was pretty cool. And, you know, that's it. We're, you know, rocking and rolling and trying not to go insane in the process.
Do you have time for one last question?
No. Yes, of course.
This one, I was just reminded by scanning over some of the comments on our Discord. The something that several of us noticed in the preview and teaser images that came out of the Ninja Turtles book from the Kickstarter is a very subtle change in some of the terminology. Specifically, that one of the changes was from attacks per melee to actions per melee. Is that a sign of things to come?
Absolutely.
Nice. All right.
Wonderful. Yeah, the Redex edition will kind of showcase a bunch of things that where we're heading.
Wow.
Wow. That's excellent. Nice. Excellent.
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah, I will say that our Discord has been going through everything y'all dropped. Like, yeah. One, just to geek over the art. And two, going like, I swear we have a archival team practically going through trying to figure out what the end product's going to look like from the little crumbs that are dropping off the edges of the promo pieces.
It seriously is. Like, every time a new Star Wars movie teaser trailer would come out, you know how within minutes there'd be people like pouring over each individual frame being like, oh my God, there's this thing in this. Oh, that's clearly a movie 2 blaster or something. And you're like, okay, where are they going here? That's what's happening with our people.
What's happening.
That's funny. That's great.
Yeah.
So yeah, people will not be disappointed. That's what I'm trying to tell folks, is that we have big plans. We're starting out kind of slow, but you know, people are so excited about it, and they're gonna love these Redux editions on so many levels. Just the art, the information, the way things are laid out, nice little tweaks that signify small little changes and clarifications and rules and presentation, you know, and that's a lot of that, Sean, a lot of that stuff that I've wanted to do for a long, long time, and we're finally getting to do. So, yeah, they're going to be very happy with that and a lot of the stuff that's coming.
Well, that, I mean, I'm jazzed. I'm like in the place where I have to like just kind of lock down to control my excitement. But I am actually super excited. I check my email daily for Palladium update. And it's been great having you on, Kevin.
It's been wonderful.
We love each and every one of these. Both the stories directly related to the role-playing game we're talking about in the episode, plus the stories around the role-playing game. And and again, thank you for sharing that. The feedback we've gotten from our listeners is they love both things, which is great. So yeah, thanks for being available again.
Oh, my pleasure. I'm loving it. And yeah, I'm only hearing positive things about your podcast too. Yay, so great job. Happy to be part of it. Thank you.
Well, that's all for now, folks. But I believe if you stay tuned another week, we'll have even more coming out.
Even more.
Even more. Thanks again, Kevin. We'll catch you next time.
Bye-bye.
Have a good one.
Starships, magic, mystic martial arts, romance. All of these can be found in A Cloak of Blades by Isaac Scher. You might have heard my name before. I've done a lot of voiceover work for Breakfast Puppies. And I've recently released my first novel. It's available on Amazon as an ebook and paperback. And you can get it for free if you have a Kindle Unlimited subscription. I do hope you'll support my work as you're supporting Breakfast Puppies. And it's been a pleasure talking with you today. Have a good one.
You've been listening to The Glitter Boys, a Palladium Books fan podcast. Glitter Boys, Rifts, the Megaverse, and all other such topics are the property of Kevin Sambita and Palladium Books. Please buy all their stuff and help keep them in print and making more games. You can order directly at palladiumbooks.com, and their entire catalog is available digitally at DriveThruRPG as well. Our opening music is 8-Bit Bass and Lead by Furby Guy from freesound.org. This closing music is Caravana by Philip Gross, available at freemusicarchive.org. All sound effects used are self-made or acquired via Creative Commons Zero License. If you like what you have heard, find us on Twitter and Facebook as The Glitter Boys. That's B-O-I-S. And check us out online at breakfastpuppies.com/glitterboys. And also join us on the Breakfast Puppies Network Discord at breakfastpuppies.com/discord. And if you want to help us out, please spread the word and help us build a community. Thanks again for listening. We'll catch you next time.